that we could slide. Mm. Get up.
23 positions in a one night stand.
Get up.
I only call you after if you say I can. Here I am.
Here I am. Get up. 1, 2, 3, 9. Little cutie, I ain't drinking. Scope this, I was just thinking. You plus me, what a ride. If you was thinking the same, could continue outside. Lay your pretty body against the parking meter. Strip your dress down like I was stripping a Peter. Pause, I'm enjoying. Let me show you, baby, I'm a talented boy.
Everybody grab a body, pump it like you want somebody.
Get up. So here we are, so here we are, so here we are. Here we are, my Paisley crib. What you want to eat?
Rib.
I'm a toy, I don't serve ribs. You better be happy that dress is still on. I heard the rip when you sat down.
Yeah, whoa. It's Morning Coffee Notes. It's your friend and mine, Dave Weiner, here coming to you live in a matter of speaking from Seattle, Washington. It's Prince. Everywhere you look, it's Prince. I was listening to Adam Curry's Daily Source Code today, and he had a caller. He had, and what music does he want to hear but Prince? And then Adam played this great set of interesting quotes from the Republican National Convention, and I'll tell you, they were Osama. No, actually, as he pointed out, it was Saddam, 9/11. 9/11, 2001, weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, Saddam, 9/11. It was starring Rudy Giuliani, who some people think Rudy Giuliani is one of the good guys, but I don't know about that. I don't know that you can be a good guy and support George Bush, so... Anyway, it's been a long time since I did a Morning Coffee Notes. I don't know where the days go, but I've just been busy with so many things. And in the meantime, the whole iPodder and podcasting thing has totally taken off. I mean, it's an incredible rush. I've never seen anything like this. And it's a joy to watch. I think that the credit for this goes to Adam Curry. It's a merger of, I think when it's all said and done, when we look back on it, like for example, today we have a very good idea, a very good perspective. I was talking with a guy yesterday at the dinner. Microsoft had a sort of blogger review of some new software that they've been working on, and of course we signed a non-disclosure and can't talk about it. And I was talking with a Microsoft guy at dinner last night, and we were talking about blogs, like they were just normal things. And it wasn't that long ago, I reflected, that you'd have to explain to somebody what a blog is, and they would sort of be disbelieving. They wouldn't, they would look at you like, you mean you're a writer and you don't write for somebody? But today that's all gone, and people understand it. And I explained it, it was just a logical outgrowth. It was just the next step in publishing. I mean, if you look at the sort of how technology has intersected with writing, and then, some writing, of course, is not publishing. If I write a letter to a friend of mine and expect that to be a private correspondence, then... that's not publishing. Although it was really interesting. I mean, this summer I read a lot of books about the founding of the United States from a political and legal standpoint. Just the history, the founding fathers and the Declaration of Independence and the War for Independence and going back to colonial America and there was a tradition. If I wrote a letter to somebody, or if Alexander Hamilton wrote a letter to John Adams, in transit, that letter would be read at every stop on the, on the route from New York to Braintree, which is where John Adams lived. Hamilton was a New Yorker, and when they wrote the letters, they knew this. So they were writing letters that were ostensibly private, but there really was no sense of privacy. I'm taking a note here because there's something I want to talk about privacy. And privacy in 2004, I think things have changed quite a bit. Our expectations have changed. I want to talk about that. But anyway, back to the dinner conversation. I was saying that it was just an absolute, total outgrowth. You could just see, it was like if you plotted the technology on a curve, you could totally see where we were going. I mean, the laser printer was a very important point on that curve. It occurred in the late 1980s, mid to late 1980s, and it dropped the price of typesetting down from hundreds of thousands of dollars and highly technical tools that required a lot of education and a lot of skill too, not just native ability, to something that, if you could learn how to use a word processor, and if you had, $5,000, you could be in the publishing business. So the web comes along, and of course, 10 years into the web, which is kind of where we are now. I know that officially it was 2 years ago, it was 10 years into the web, but a lot of 10-year anniversaries are coming up, which I might mention Thursday. I should do a Morning Coffee Notes on Thursday. Morning Coffee Notes have kind of taken the place of DaveNet. I stopped writing DaveNet. I don't even remember exactly when I stopped writing it. I could find out quickly. Let's go to davenet.scripting.com. It's been in the last year. It hasn't been longer than that. Let's just see. davenet.scripting.com. Yes, March 8th, 2004 was the last one. It was a good one, actually. It was about the, it was just an announcement, kind of like the first one was, just an announcement. It was an announcement of the Harvard case study on blogging, which was a very thoroughly researched study on how bloggers affected the downfall of the Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott. And it wasn't an exclusive. It was the interesting thing about that report was that it showed that it wasn't just bloggers, that there was collaboration and cooperation between professional reporters and bloggers, which I felt was a very positive. First of all, I'm sure it was true. And second, I was glad that they chose that as their first case study, because although since then, Alex Jones, who is the director of the Shorenstein Center, which commissioned the study, who was a very brilliant debater. I had lunch with him and Rebecca McKinnon, and it was intense. But I felt very intellectually challenged, but didn't feel like I was at all overwhelmed. And since then, Jones has made many public appearances on television, network television, cable television. He wrote an op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times, which got broad circulation in the blogosphere. Not intellectually honest. Very, very rhetorical, inflammatory, paranoid even, and way, way beneath him. I mean, this was a guy who I felt we could work with that had, intellectual honesty, but very disappointed in what came from that. But there is that one point on the curve, the case study that the Shorenstein Center produced, and it tells a different story from what Jones is telling. It says that bloggers and there's a symbiosis between the professionals and the amateurs, and that's really all that's going on. When they make such a big deal out of it, then they look really scared, and they really don't need to fear from us, because the forces that are at work in their profession, really, the bloggers are really symptomatic of that. The economics are working against their model from the 20th century. and the bloggers are rising to fill the spaces. And well, anyway, so you never know what you're going to get in a morning coffee notes there. I didn't even know what I would find when I went there. But yeah, I stopped writing DaveNets partially because, you know, it was an email thing that was archived on the web, and email became unusable. And I felt that the readership was dropping precipitously because it was being filtered. You know, this looked like spam to a lot of the spam filters, and you know, I got tired of fighting it. And I won't say always, but for a long time, I've wanted to just do all my writing on the web and leave it at that, because I feel like that's more my medium, and that DaveNet is sort of where I started, and that the web is where I'm at. And by creating that space, I could go to different places, and hence the audio blog posts, hence podcasting, hence iPodder, you know, all of an outgrowth of blogging and RSS. It's all just a continuum. And we're going to get OPML in there, and that leads me to the next subject. Been working with Adam Curry for the last week or so, although Adam has actually been working on this unbeknownst to me for about a month, since September 5th, I think, was when he started. And he's doing an OPML directory of two branches. One are the tools that you can use to play back podcast streams. These are called the iPodders. That's just the way it worked out. And the other fork is on the streams themselves. So it's the analog to web browsers and to web logs. And we still have to fill in a lot of pieces. We have to fill in the equivalent of the content management system. So, you know, what tools you use for composing and creating, podcasts. And it's still sort of a dark art. I mean, but in a beautiful time of its life. It's a joy to watch Adam do his development through the Daily Source Code. And it's and I love working with him on the Trade Secrets, which is another project we're doing. It's secrets.scripting.com. It's a podcast channel, and it's Adam and myself. So we're starting a directory, and the idea is to make it easy for people to find the cool stuff, which, if you think about it, that's kind of what Adam did, and it's kind of what I did. I know Adam, in his MTV days, his job was to listen to all the videos and to artistically combine them in a way that that defined what MTV was, or and still is, really. Although, you know, of course, it's changed a bit over the last, 20-some-odd years. And it's very much like what my blog is. I mean, my blog has some original content. Maybe 25% is original, and 75% is pointers with excerpts to things that are off-site. And I don't know what the, actual balance is going to turn out to be in what we're doing, specifically what Adam is doing. And for all I know, maybe I'm totally wrong. Maybe this isn't the way it's going to go at all. Maybe Adam will just be doing soliloquies from here on out. It could turn out that way, but I don't think it will. I think that it's in his nature to sort of riff off of what other people are doing. And he is a web-like person. And the web philosophy says, when I discover something that's really cool, I tell you about it. And so I kind of think that's where we're headed. So that's at iPodder.org. And you might want to bookmark that one. You might want to subscribe to that in your RSS feeds. It's going to be a frequently updated site. So anyway, on to the next subject. This morning, I unveiled for the first time the preliminary grid, the schedule for BloggerCon 3 on November 6th. The URL for that is www.bloggercon.org/III, which is 3/schedule. And if you go there, you'll see it's broken out into, there are several rooms, and then there are sessions in each room, and each session, of course, has a title and a discussion leader, and links, the title links to the description that the discussion leader wrote for that particular session. And it's sort of, that itself is an art too, as well. How do you put these things together, and what do you put opposite each other? And that's gonna, we'll tweak that up over time. Things will change there. Don't plan your travel schedules around it. I also want to say about the wait list situation. We have more room than I thought we had, at the time that I did the cutoff at 250. So if you're on the wait, and of course, quite a few of the people who signed up probably won't come. So I'm going to ask for people to confirm their position, basically. Or, you know, if they know that they're not coming, I'm going to ask them to go to a page and click on a button to say that they're not coming so that the numbers readjust and more people will come in underneath. If anything, we'll if we need to do this, we'll prioritize it so that the early birds... And we have to make room for the Stanford people. This is a requirement and a very understandable one. They very generously are hosting this event, and it's a Stanford event, and in addition to being a blogger event. And so we need to make room for them as well. And all told, we're gonna try to accommodate everybody that wants to come. That's the always been the philosophy of BloggerCon, and somehow it's always worked out. Always is just two times, but I sort of feel like the people who really need to be there will be there, and there'll be room for them. And the contingency plan would be that on the early session, the podcasting session, which right now there's nothing opposite it. However, there have been some ideas like that maybe we'd move the newbies session right opposite that session, because presumably the newbies, you know, may not be ready yet to hear about, you know, this discussion may be over their heads. I don't know. But there may be some things we can do that are simultaneous with that. But if you have a high number, we may not, you know, you may not get into that session, but you can get into everything else. We'll try to work it out. I have a feeling it's going to work. So I'm not telling anybody at this point that they're not getting in definitively. If you're under 250, you're getting in. But we're going to get really busy on this now. And I'm going down to California for Thursday, Friday, and Saturday for meetings with Stanford people, I hope, although it's kind of late last minute thing. And with discussion leaders who are in the Bay Area, and in just general to sort of take in the space and get ready for the last legs of planning for this event. We've got basically about 4 weeks, a little bit over 4 weeks right now before BloggerCon 3. It's Saturday, November 6th is when it is. Anyway, right now it's 5 o'clock Pacific time. We're about an hour away from the vice presidential debate. I'm really looking forward to it. Presidential debate was just utterly fantastic. It was what I had hoped for. You know, cynically, I thought that, you know, we're getting another one of the lesser of two evils decisions in this election. And I wasn't happy about it, although I was glad to have a chance to vote George Bush out of office, because, you know, we really need to do that. I wasn't thinking that Kerry would be a great leader, but he's got greatness in him. There's no question about it. That was a very well done, very presidential, very inspirational presentation that he did. And I listened to it. I watched it, and I was sitting on the edge of my chair the whole time. You know, and I was delighted with what I saw. And then I did the download from audible.com and then listened to it. And, you know, Bush didn't do as badly as I had remembered that he had. But it wasn't so much that how much Bush sucked, but it was that Kerry was really very good. And you could see that the seeds of that strength had been laid really skillfully. Maybe going back as far as his time in Vietnam. It's possible. Or that he, you know, the Swift Boat guys ran the ads. The second round of ads were about Kerry's testimony in the Senate after he came back from Vietnam. And they basically played sort of, pretended that Vietnam was World War II. And had Kerry done that in World War II, they would have been right. You know, he was giving comfort to the enemy if the enemy was Hitler and the Nazis. Or, you know, because there we were fighting evil. There was no question about it. I mean, you know, maybe some people do question it. I don't question that. But in the case of Vietnam, I think that the goodness and the badness was spread around pretty evenly. I don't think we had any business being there. I didn't think so at the time. And there was a broad consensus, not a majority necessarily, but there were a lot of people that agreed with Kerry at the time that he did that. Somebody needed to speak up for that. And a person who had just come back from Vietnam and risked his life, an honored veteran, gets to make the point that he made so well, is that you have to make a distinction between the war and the soldier. And this is our failure. This was our failure in Vietnam. We didn't make that distinction, and we ended up blaming the soldiers for the mistake that the country made. And you know, you could say, well, it's understandable, it's human and whatnot, but it was also grossly unfair. He had every right to stand up and say what he said. If he believed it, he not only had a right to say it, but he had a responsibility to say it. That wasn't the kind of war where giving comfort to the enemy was the main issue. We didn't belong there. We shouldn't have been there. And a lot of people, by the time we were out of Vietnam, a great majority of the American people felt that way. And nobody that I heard from at that time stood up and said that we should have stayed in Vietnam all the way through. We weren't going to win, and we didn't belong there. And it's very much the same kind of situation as Iraq. So Kerry is the right candidate for 2004. He links back to that period where we forgot what we had learned. As a country, we had forgotten what we learned. Now, Bush and his neocons may not have learned that. You know, Cheney was in Wyoming. He wasn't in a city. He didn't fight in Vietnam. I don't know if he had friends who went to fight in Vietnam. I did. And Bush, I don't know about Bush. Bush reminds me of a really shitty sales guy at a high-tech company. A guy who's been skating through life and, you know, doesn't really engage in anything. And he speaks in slogans and he acts like he's tough, but it's all bluster. And he isn't intelligent. And I just, part of me just says, you know, I can't reconcile the two. You can't be president of the United States without being really, really smart. But everything I see in Bush says he's the guy who did it. In any case, I'm looking forward to the vice presidential debate. I hope that Cheney, well, let's just wait and see. I mean, I saw Edwards speak about a year and a half ago. First time I saw Edwards speak was on a tiny little kiosk in, gosh, if I don't remember the name of the town. I have pictures from it, in New Hampshire. There were about 100 people sitting in this kiosk. It was on a, it was summer. It was more than a year and a half ago. Was it? It was like September. It was 2 years ago. Could that be right? No, it was a year ago. Wow. What a loop. It was a year ago. It was September of 2003. It was, And he was a long shot boy. I remember watching him thinking, God, people used to say he was such hot shit. And he sure didn't look like hot shit there that night. He looked like, he looked a little bit like what I was describing there with Bush. Except he doesn't have any trouble putting sentences together. But the ideas, there didn't seem to be any sincerity to him. And later in the campaign, he learned how to project the sincerity. But I doubt if it's there. He's a really good actor, and I don't know what his game is. I don't know why he decided that he wanted to be a national politician when he did. You know, the story is that his son had died. He lost his interest in being a lawyer, but that sounds a little too neat to me. I don't know. I like Edwards because I think he has a chance of winning. Once he's in there, I don't know. And by the way, the same thing with Kerry. If Kerry gets elected, and I sincerely hope that he does, and I'm voting for the guy, and I urge you to do the same if you have a vote in this election. But when he becomes president, we got to make it clear to him that he's not going to be pulling the same kind of shit that George Bush did. And I don't know how we get that point made. Maybe now's the time to make a deal with him. If you're an undecided voter or a Republican and you don't like the way things are going in the country, maybe now's the time for you guys to stand up and say, okay, Kerry, this is what it's going to take for me to vote for you. And don't bring in abortion and don't bring in stem cell research or gay marriage or anything moral like that, because he can't give on that and he shouldn't give on that. Bush never should have had a position on those things. The president of the United States should stay out of that kind of stuff. It's not his job. It's not his business. It's a transparent way to get votes for doing absolutely nothing. What we need from Kerry is we need some accountability. We need to know that he's going to run the country for the general interest, not just for the interest of the people that bought him the election, the people who paid for his commercials. And I have no negotiating leverage with him at all. I'm voting for him. I'm exactly the kind of person that votes for Kerry. But if you're the kind of person who isn't naturally the person who votes for Kerry, now's the time to offer. Make your deal. You can do it now. Anyway, just a thought. I would think that he's starting to make sounds like that. Like, he's starting to make some of these commitments, and I hope he means them, but it's an interesting place. So, anyway, one more thing that I noticed. Two more things. I want to talk about privacy, and I want to talk about Scoble. It's really been, in the trade secrets, the last trade secrets, I called out specifically thanks to Steve Gilmore. Since I mentioned it, thanks again. There aren't that many people in the technology business that I trust. And so the people that you really trust are very special. And Steve Gilmore is one of them, and Robert Scoble is another. Trust is something that you feel. It's a feeling. But it's not just a feeling. It's also experience. It's also builds. It builds over time. You watch to see how people do things. You make observations that maybe they're not trying to call to your attention, but you make them anyway. And you just watch and you see how they do things. And nobody's perfect. And so there have been times when Steve Gilmore and Scoble, of course, I've felt betrayed by them or don't really understand why they did or said what they did. But then, of course, like I said, we're all human, right? But in balance, I watched Scoble in action. He was there. He's an interesting place because he's both a blogger and he's from Microsoft. And so he's in the room with a lot of us. We were sitting in the quote-unquote audience, and the Microsoft people were up on stage. Nobody really questioned this because, they were paying for it, In my case, they didn't pay for my travel expenses or hotel. I was already here, and I already have a place to live. So in my case, I could have said, hey, why don't you guys just let's flatten the structure out here. In fact, I'm working for you for free here, so, you know, don't think of this as feedback. Let's think about this a different way, you know. But I didn't make an issue of that, or at least didn't make too much of an issue. But Scobel there was in an interesting place because he was both a blogger and a Microsoft guy, and that put him in a place where, you know, the question is, what's he going to do? And I watched this, and Scobel was a blogger. And, you know, all we saw of his Microsoft allegiance is that he has more information than the rest of us do, and had it earlier. But otherwise, we were singing the same song. And I talked with him this afternoon, and I'm going to try to set up a time we're going to do an interview. And I'm just going to set down my new laptop in front of both of us, and we'll just talk for an hour. And I'm going to deliberately try to make sure that I only talk like maybe, you know, 25% of the time and let him have 75%. Because the idea is to try to get him bootstrapped into the podcasting situation, because he belongs there. He should be there, and when he is, he's going to Zoom. It's going to be really cool to watch to see what happens. And I'm glad to do that because I know that when I'm doing that, I'm adding wealth to all of our web presences. And it'll be interesting because here's a blogger that's in the heart of a very unblog-like organization. And hats off to the organization too for having the courage to do that, because I think it's rare. Okay, one more topic, and then I'm just going to go into production mode and get ready to watch the debate. The subject of passport and privacy came up at at our 2-day session here at Microsoft. And David Weinberger, who I've known for quite a few years, he's one of the Clue Train authors. He kind of has, he's at Berkman Center, where I was for the last year and a half, where I was a fellow. David is this year is a fellow at Berkman Center. And we joked a bit about, you know, that's the blogger chair at the Berkman Center. And it's good, you know, that they have a designated blogger is a good thing. Every academic institution should have one. As we've seen, Microsoft has 1,000 bloggers, but there's a Pied Piper in there, and his name is Scobel. Anyway, so Weinberger and I, it's funny because at a philosophical level, I've said this to him before, that we are in total agreement on the philosophy of the web. And we're actually going to have a session on this at BloggerCon called The Core Values of the Web. The idea that it's going to be led by Mary Hodder from Berkeley, and I think she's now at Technorati also. And it's an academic subject. It's a question of, well, what is... At one point, when I went to Amsterdam, I went to the W3C meeting in Amsterdam. I think it was in 2000. It was in 2000. And I wrote about that, saying I was looking for the heart of the web and didn't find it. That's okay. I mean, at one point that was the heart of the web, but the web had moved on and was a lot more than that at that time, and it of course is today even more than that. But the web does have a heart, and it does have a philosophy, and we're sort of like the blind men and the elephant, and we're all sort of looking at different parts of it. And Weinberger is one of those people, and he's written some great books. Small Pieces Loosely Joined is one of his books, and of course the Clue Train Manifesto, which I think is one side of the coin, and the other side of the coin is blogs. And we seem to be, you know, I was a math major, and math, very theoretical type math, not, you know, And in math, the great thing about math, the reason why people love math, is because there's this sort of, you can approach a theorem from 5 different approaches, and you always end up at the same place. And it shows you that something that it's very hard to describe in words, other than to say that this is what beauty is. Beauty is where you discover the underlying law that explains the nature of something that one wouldn't necessarily think has an underlying law. That, and the web is like that. The web, the essential element of the web is the link. And it goes all the way from the deepest technology all the way up to the simplest user interface, that the where you link, you're like the web. Where you are exclusive, when you don't link, you are not like the web. So Weinberger and I agree on everything, but today, or actually it was yesterday, we found something that we don't agree on, and I think I'm right, and I think he's wrong. So I thought, wow, this is a momentous occasion. Let's celebrate it. Of course, I think I'm right, and I think that if in a short while he will agree with me, because I once was where he is. He asked a question. He said, you know, will this require the use of Passport? And the Microsoft person said, yes. And he said, well, then I won't use it. And that's certainly a place where I was once. And no, I don't have a Passport. On the other hand, I'm probably going to give in and get one. And there's a reason for that, because the world has changed. First of all, when we were against it, there was this idea that we would all work together and we would create something that was open and democratic and not controlled by a major monolithic antitrust violating, you know, convicted company that couldn't be trusted, you know. And all that's very valid, and it's still valid. And this is how Microsoft screwed not just themselves, but all of us too, because they should have been much more careful about earning and keeping our trust. Or not just our trust, but deserving of trust. And no, we would be wrong to trust them. But on the other hand, we would be even wronger not to do something about identity theft. Do something about it. Take some step to protect yourself. In another conversation, I said to one of the people at the conference, I said, you know, let's create a hardened laptop. Let's create one where if I lose the laptop or it's stolen, they don't automatically get all my sensitive information off there. Why is this a concern? Because more and more our financial affairs are moving onto the internet. It's just too convenient, and there are too many incentives for us to do it. Businesses, you know, will give us a few points off if we are willing to move all of our business on the internet, because it's cheaper for them to not have to print out and mail out invoices, and they're willing to share the savings on that. At some point, you're not even going to have the option of getting paper. You're going to have to do it electronically, and at that point, we're all going to be very vulnerable. And mass hijackings of identities will be taking place. And we'll look back at this period and we'll think, we didn't do anything to protect ourselves. Well, it's kind of like the situation with the Republicans and Kerry. Okay, I mean, the Microsoft people shrug their shoulders, they're bewildered, they don't know what to do, right? If people have objections to using Passport, what are they supposed to say to them? Where is the alternative? Who could they work with? None of the options that existed in 2001 or whenever it was, Liberty Alliance didn't materialize. AOL has since collapsed. It's now a very poor division of Time Warner. Sun Microsystems also is a shadow of its former self. I know that Jonathan Schwartz won't like to hear that, but it's true. There really isn't anybody else to take the lead here. So, you know, and at the same time, our attitudes about privacy have shifted. You know, what's important versus what's not. The people who are going to attack us and are attacking us are, believe me, they're a lot less trustworthy than Bill Gates and Microsoft. They're a lot more scary than Bill Gates and Microsoft. So it's... You know, we're caught between a rock and a hard place, and we can't afford the luxury of being so black and white on this issue. That said, you know, we have virtually eponymous names and virtually eponymous philosophies, and I think that this is purely a pragmatic issue, and we're going to have to try to work with Microsoft on this one, I think. That's my feeling about it, and that's sort of my message in the bottle for my friends at Berkman, and for the Stanford Internet and Society group at the Harvard Law School, at the Stanford Law School, sorry, for the EFF, for all of the organizations that are, the ACLU probably has an opinion about this too. For all those organizations, we need to try to take a step here, I think, and take another look at this one, because we do need to do something about this pretty soon. Anyway, that's it for this Morning Coffee Notes. I'm Dave Weiner. My blog is Scripting News. It's www.scripting.com. If you want to subscribe to these feeds, my RSS 2.0 with enclosures feed is www.scripting.com/rss.xml. And we'll see you again really soon. I think we're going to do a trade secrets probably tomorrow. And, you know, Murphy willing, knock wood, I'm not a lawyer, my mother loves me, all the usual disclaimers. We'll see you again real soon. Thanks. Bye.